Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
I think it's time to welcome everybody who's come to this session. My name is Adrian Harris. I'm the channel manager for Ecology and Research, and I'm delighted to be welcoming Thomas Shaw Conn, who has 25 years of teaching wilderness awareness and shamanism. He's been doing martial arts since he was 8, and one of his mentors was Tom Brown Jr., who he'll be saying a bit more about, but he's one of the very early, one of the roots of wilderness awareness training. So very significant mentor to have. So I think without further ado, we'll go straight over to Thomas. Thank you for joining us.
Great, thank you. So hi, everybody who's joined. Welcome. So the title of my talk is From Normal to Natural. And how to master our inner states and develop a strong connection. So I've been working with training people in nature connection skills for around 25 years. And one of the major skills that I work with is called stalking. And this is moving silently and invisibly in nature. And as a practice, it doesn't really have a very good name these days. If you say you're practicing stalking, you know, you might get arrested. So what I'd like to do is to contextualize what that is. And I'm going to do that through sharing a story of something that happened about 18 years ago. I was invited to join a group of mentors. There were 10 mentors, and we took 10 young men from the inner city in London. They'd all been excluded from school in the St. Paul's area. So they were a lovely bunch of very lively mixed race young men. And we were sort of involved in the idea of reinventing a rite of passage for these young men. So I arrived in Wales, in this beautiful place, Caermarthen, and in the first evening I realized that because there were 10 mentors, there were 10 agendas. And so my 9, and so I just explained to the young men my skill sets, said, hey, this is what I can do. If you're interested, come and find me at any point. Halfway through the week, two young men came to me and they said, we want to go into the woods and kill something. And I said, great, come on, let's go. You'll need a stick. It's bigger than a stone. When you throw it, it has a larger surface area. This is our primary projectile. Let's go. And we went off into the woods. And after about half an hour, I said to them, oh, have you seen anything? And they said, no, we haven't seen anything. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. How stupid of me. I should have shown you how to move silently and invisibly through the forest. And so I trained them in how to stalk, how to move, how to place the foot, how to walk in a natural way that creates far less disturbance in nature and brings us into a slightly different state. Half an hour later, I say to them, "Have you seen anything?" I said, no, we haven't seen anything." I said, "Oh, maybe you're just too noisy inside. This is a nice spot. Sit down and I'll show you how to quieten down that inner dialogue, well, monologue." Sat them down and taught them to meditate. They sort of come out of their meditation. You know, I can see and sense that they've been deep inside themselves and they're much stiller as they come out. It's getting dark and I say, "Hey, we need to head back." So we start to head back and there's a gap in the forest and I pause to watch the sun set. And one of them says, "Isn't that beautiful?" So we've gone from, "I want to go into the woods and kill something," to, "Isn't that beautiful?" And all I've taught them are the skills of stalking and connection with nature. Things to help us move more silently and invisibly through the forest. Things to help us still our inner noise so that we create less disturbance. I knew we would see nothing. That I wasn't concerned about that. But I think that if all of our young people understood what was involved in the hunt effectively, in our capacity to become at one with the natural world, then maybe they would be behaving differently. But this is a piece that has been stolen from our culture. It's kind of dropped out of the culture. Hunting is seen as something very negative. And the way that it's practiced, frankly, is often very negative. You know, rearing a whole load of pheasants and then beating them into a particular place so that you can take pot shots at them. This is not hunting. This is not in the spirit of the hunt. So I'm teaching stalking to my students when I'm teaching them the skills of living on the earth. And the skills of survival really help us to feel at home wherever we stand on this earth. And that's a feeling for me that I'd wanted since I was a child. And that only really came to me after my first week of training with Tom Brown Jr. And I really started after that week to feel like wherever I stood, that was my own. And then I had a serious reverse culture shock as I went into Grand Central Station in the middle of Manhattan, 6 million people. And that was really kind of shocking. And that took about 2 years to overcome. So students come, I train them in stalking. I'm watching carefully what's happening. I'm paying attention. And in order to get them to really drop into the state, I hold the space for them to move. So a stalking step takes 1 minute per step, between 1 minute and 66 seconds. So I'm counting a minute per step for 10 steps for them to really slow down. And what I find is that at minute six, the birds start singing around students for the first time since they've been in the woods with me. And I know what this means in terms of them having dropped into a deeper state of connection. But I'm still very curious as to why at 6 minutes this happens every time. So I start to research this and I'm looking at brainwave entrainment and how if we want to entrain the brain into a different state, then, and there are various means of doing this that I could talk about, but time is short, so I'm going to leave that aside. If you have questions about that, then please ask. So brainwave entrainment, it takes 6 minutes to entrain a different state. And what I was finding was that the birds started to express a different relationship to the students, to reflect them back to themselves in a different way, as if they weren't there. They were behaving in what we call a baseline behavior, because the birds are the natural alarm system of the forest, and they reflect us back to ourselves. And so what I was witnessing was the reflection being a really positive one. And with this 6 minute understanding from the scientific perspective of it taking 6 minutes to entrain into a different brainwave state, I then started to want to be able to support my students' experience, because they're having this experience. But what would happen is they go home and they try and explain it, and they wouldn't have any kind of framework for explaining it. And often that experience would kind of be stolen from them, or they would lose it because they had no way of explaining it. So I started to look into this, and I discovered the work of Otto Schumann, who in 1953 discovered, or he theorized that there was a natural earth resonance. And so he was looking at what was going on, and he was like, well, there's some 2,000 thunderstorms kicking off around the planet at any one time. 50 lightning strikes per storm. This is a lot of electromagnetic energy. And so this is obviously Mercury retrograde causing these sort of technological problems. This is... Okay, so...
The Earth resonance, EMF.
Okay, so we've got this ultra-low frequency, 0.83 hertz, that Otto Schumann figured out and then measured 10 years later with a couple of other physicists. They figured out the mechanism to be able to measure this in the forest, over the sea, but not in the city. The 50 hertz electrical pulse of AC current knocks this out. Then in the 70s, they started making Schumann generators, and NASA put one in every spaceship that it sent outside the ionosphere, because they were having problems with the astronauts existing outside of that natural resonance. So I'm watching the students, and I'm starting to realize that what's happening is that their resonance state is slowing down to the point where it's meeting the Schumann resonance. And that's when the birds are starting to recognize them as part of the natural resonance, as opposed to us in a normal state of human consciousness. And so there are four main brainwave states that we experience. And the so-called normal state of human consciousness is at a quite a high frequency. And as we get into stalking mode, that starts to slow down. It takes us about 6 minutes. And then we come into a state of oneness with the energy that moves in and through all things, because our brainwave state has slowed down. Our resonant pool starts to match the greater resonant field. And then birds and animals stop reacting to us because they feel us as kin at that point. So having figured this out, I could then give my students a framework to understand what was happening so that nobody could steal that experience from them. I continued my research. Both, so stalking is a physical activity, and you're moving at 1 minute per step. This is a very difficult physical activity, because you need a lot of balance. And so I was looking at this to try and understand how I might make it simpler for people. And I've practiced Qigong for a long time, meditation for a long time, and stalking for a long time. And I started to find that if I took one component from each of these apps, and I could provide a mechanism for people to access the forest state, this natural resonant state, within a very short space of time. And by, again, running experiments using brainwave measuring technology, I found that I could get somebody into this state inside of 2 minutes, which is faster than the science says is possible. So the science says this, it takes 6 minutes to access this state through entrainment. So I'm going to share with you a bit later on a method that I call Alpha Breath Dynamics, which is very simple, that helps us to access this state. And like I said, it takes only 2 minutes. So I have a number of images that I'd like to share with you. Yes, so this is the first one. Oh, hold on. Screen share. Yes. So I'd like to share this image. So if we take the four different brainwave states and we imagine that they're a series of circles or spheres, the slowest brainwave state is 0 to 4 hertz, and then 4 to 8. So this is the delta state, 0 to 4. The theta state is 4 to 8. The alpha state is 8 to 12, and these are all approximate. And then the so-called normal state is from about 13 to 26. So I continued my research because training in shamanism, I'm really interested in how it is we can access these states really swiftly. And there are three main schools of shamanism. There's working with medicine plants, there's dreaming, and there's stalking. And obviously, I'm from the stalking school of shamanism, and that's what I trained in with Tom Brown Jr. So we're working more with using envisioning, visualization as a means of accessing these different states. But I'm finding that the students and myself are accessing alpha range through stalking. So this is, if you like, the first or the state of the energy of all things, the natural resonant state. And then I come across a piece of research that shows that, this means that this information and connection is embedded in each human. So when a baby is born, they spend the first 2 to 4 years in a delta state. So they've come from the source, and they're then resonant in this delta state. And the word that I apply to the delta state is the word awe. And when we meet a baby, we go, oh, we can feel that resonant state. We remember it. It's there in our cells. And so we have this, you know, if you've ever had any children and you're walking down the street with a baby, strangers come up to you to be in that presence because there's something about it that they know is really magical and special. And so each of us has been gifted 2 to 4 years of understanding this unconditioned state. And so this is why I've used the term remember, you know, I'm helping you to remember the shaman you already are. And as far as I'm concerned, a good teacher is just helping you to remember the things that are already within you, but maybe you haven't been mentored to be able to find them. Once that connection with nature or that connection with spirit is established, then the conversation is in your hands. And that's how my teachers have trained me. They've helped me to make that connection with nature and spirit. And then they go, look, you're going to learn way more from spirit and nature than you are from me. That's what I consider to be a good teacher. And that's, I follow in that approach, that we make these connections and then it's up to us to continue that conversation. So here we are as a baby. We've got 2 to 4 years in a delta state. In the delta state, the growth hormone is triggered and our brain is 95% grown by the time we're 4. So then if I move on to the next image. So that's one. This is this is 2. Okay, yes. So here we are. So then from 4 to 8 years. So at the age of 4, our imagination really kicks off and we start to play let's pretend, and you know we're involved in all these imaginary games, and you know I've seen some wonderful things with children who are in this place. I was once at a campsite with a whole group of families and all the children ran off and were being feral everywhere, and there was this one child who was a bit more arty than the others. Both his parents were artists, and the other kids were like, yeah, well he's a bit weak, we can sort of, you know, bully him a bit. And as they all rounded on him, I watched as he drew his imaginary sword, And then they clutch their imaginary weapons. And this whole imaginary battle started to take place. And I was like, wow, that's fantastic. He's defended himself with his imagination. How awesome is that? And then he became the leader. They were like, oh, what game can we play next? So, this is the sort of realm that we then enter. And as adults, we enter this realm in every 24-hour period, because when we're in REM sleep, when we're dreaming, then if we measured your brainwave state, it would be in a theta state. If you took a teaching plant and we measured your brainwave state, we would get a theta reading, because this is the realm of spirit proper, access the spiritual realms. And here there's no physical limitation, and there's no time or all time, and vast amounts of energy. And because that the parameters of this state, and having trained many, many children and schools over the years, I've observed children very carefully, and I would observe especially the ADHD children, and I'd see, wow, loads of energy. They also had this knowing things without knowing how they would know them. So we'd camouflage an instructor so that you could stand on the instructor and you wouldn't know they were there. And they'd go, well, what are you doing down there? Or we'd been walking through the forest canopy and suddenly they'd look up and go, what's that? And a hawk would be flying over the gap in the trees that was, you know, the size of a hula hoop. So this is knowing things without knowing how you know them, which is also allied with this state. And obviously they had loads of energy. And I started to form a theory that they must be in the theta state. And several years later, I found some research that backed this up, and that by in training ADHD children and adults into alpha, they would lose the, they would sort of develop into that next state. And then I started to think, well, why would you have stayed there? And then this capacity of knowing things without knowing how you know them, I started to think, wow, that is really something that usually takes a lot of development to find that quality and that capacity. And maybe they were in a traumatic environment where, you know, as an example, maybe dad would come back drunk a couple of times a month and be violent. And they could tell, they could feel it before he would come in the door. So why would they let go of that facility? So I started to develop a theory that as you can see, we've got 4 to 8 years. So this is, again, 4 years in this imaginary state, in this state of using the imagination. And if we get traumatized in this period, if a child is traumatized in this period, and hey, it's not difficult to traumatize a tiny sensitive being. It's no blame in respect of that, unless obviously the circumstances are extreme. And then my view is that the next stage of brainwave development is held back. So that means that when we engage in the alpha breath dynamics, if you have ADHD or you think that there may be some trauma that has meant that you've stayed in that state, then it's possible that that trauma might arise. So anybody who's in that category, I'd like you to have some support with you when you engage in the activity. Just to illustrate this, again, this was a theory until I saw it with my own eyes. So I'm there at an event, I've got a marquee set up, and two young men say, hey, can we come and hang out in your space? I say, sure, help yourself. And one of them is sort of fidgeting about, like he's obviously got ADHD. And I've just developed my alpha breath dynamics. And I say, hey, I'd really love to share this with you. Are you okay with that? And he really didn't want to, but he was also aspergic, so he could really feel that I was coming from a good place. Sorry, I'm going to stop the share so that I can come back to here. So he could really feel. So we went through this for 2 minutes. And after 2 minutes, suddenly he was sitting there like a Buddha. And he said, "I've never felt this calm in all my life." And then about a minute later, he burst into tears. And he said, "I was sexually abused as a young man, and I have never told anybody." It was, and then his friend was like, "Oh, mate." It was the most beautiful moment of revealing this trauma that he had held that was causing all of these perturbations in his experience. And it also, for me, it helped me to understand that if the trauma is quite extreme, then it may arise as we move into this next phase. So I'm going to find the next one, which I think I seem to have lost one. So we're going straight to the next two, in fact. So then just one more thing about imagination, and that is that Einstein, he said, well, logic will take you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere else. He also said, if you want your children to be intelligent, read them fairy stories. If you want them to be really intelligent, read them loads of fairy stories. And as we explore and move through these different stages, as a parent, we can be relating more skillfully to our children as we understand which of the different brainwave states they're more likely to be in. I was at an event. I was witnessing this mother trying to put sun cream on her daughter. She was wriggling around. I watched this for a good 5-10 minutes. And then I went over, I couldn't help it. I went over and I said to her daughter, "I bet you can't stay as still as a statue for 5 minutes." And just engaged that imaginative game playing sort of quality. Immediately she was like this. And her mother, you know, took the opportunity to cover her in suntan lotion. And so when we understand what our children are moving through, then we can relate very much more skillfully to them and traumatize them less. And also then we kind of know what we should be doing with them for ages, because as they move into the next phase, the alpha state, the flow state, which is about calm and focus, then this is the natural resonant state of nature. And so as they're moving into this age range, we want to really anchor them in experience of nature. And also just to remind you that if you're an adult, you have been through all of these stages as you grew up. So these are entirely natural. There's nothing unnatural about these aspects. It's just that nobody showed you how to access and work with these different states. And that's where the mastery comes in. And so to be able to access the alpha state inside of 2 minutes anywhere, at any time, well, that's a great gift, as far as I'm concerned, because one of the things that happens around the age of 13, as puberty kicks in, we shift then into the beta state, what is considered the state of human consciousness. And this is where the prefrontal cortex gets busy arguing with itself. The self-critical mind is born at this point, and it only exists in that beta state. The minute we shift out of the beta state into calm and focus, gone. The mind is still. And most meditation is about helping the mind to calm down in that way, to slow down. But the minute we sit down, the mind gets really busy. And so this is the beauty of stalking, because we're moving, but we're moving in a quality of flow. And it's that quality of flowing movement that is bringing us into this state. So one of the things that happens when we shift into alpha is that the dialogue, so-called the monologue that we're having with ourselves, can still. And this, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, one of the things that that this can give us in a way that is really a phenomenal gift. And so this is the reason that I'm suggesting is that what is considered the normal state of human consciousness may well be normal, but it's not natural. The alpha state, the flow state, is the natural state. And the as we come, you know, we sit around the fire and we drift into alpha. We get involved in something that we love. Time goes. This is one of the characteristics that Mihai Csikszentmihalyi discovered in his exploration into the flow state in his book Flow that he wrote in the 80s. And I've been looking at the characteristics that he's developed and have developed another 8 characteristics of my own, because he studied people who went into a flow state, athletes, artists, etc., who accessed the flow state, were in the zone. And he studied them externally. My study has been from accessing those states myself. And so there are all kinds of shifts that occur that if you're involved in studying that for yourself, you discover, such as your senses really start to open up. And the key to that is one of the components of being and the alpha breath dynamics. And that is how we use our eyes. So we're used to just staring in this very narrow focus of vision at one or another. What we're going to do in order to access the alpha state, the flow state, is we're going to do something that Tom Brown Jr. calls wide angle vision, or the use of our full peripheral vision. And this is a really crucial component of stalking. And so I've taken that from stalking. And the way that we can do it, I can't really extend my arms fully and you see what I'm doing. So imagine my arms out, and then I'm going to just wiggle my fingers, but with my arms extended. And by keeping my eyes looking forwards, yes, maybe I can do it like this. And so I'm witnessing the movement. So there isn't a very fine focus on that movement, but I see the movement of both of my hands and fingers wiggling. Okay, so here I am. This is as far as I can go in the image. So give this a try. And as you expand your field of vision in this way, all of your other senses follow, because your eyes are one of your primary senses. So this immediately creates a much greater sensory experience. And then we start to really come into an embodiment of our senses. Our whole body starts to act as a sensitive medium, and information from the environment starts to sort of meet our body, and we start to feel much more clearly. The wide angle vision can also really help to quieten down the mind. Okay, so this is one of the components of the alpha breath dynamics. The second component came from practicing a particular meditation. I was feeling very anxious, and I came across the HeartMath Institute, and they've done 20 years worth of research into a particular form of breathing, where you breathe in for 5 seconds and then you breathe out for 5 seconds. And what they found is that your heart is producing a sine wave, but it's quite incoherent. And if you need 5 minutes of this slow in-breath, slow out-breath, then the heart comes into a very coherent state that lasts for up to 4 hours. Now, I don't believe anything that anybody tells me or anything that I read. I run my own experiments, and that's how I come to a conclusion. And I ran an experiment of trying that meditation for about a year. and found that within the first week, my anxiety had left me. And so I continued to practice this. And, you know, on that note, what I would advise is please don't believe a word I tell you, because that's just lazy. Run your own experiments and come to your own conclusions, because your personal experience is the most valuable thing that you have. That is more valuable than anything else. So if you haven't been running many experiments, start. You know, it's a bit like this notion, and I'm going off on a slight tangent here for a moment, of a question. When we break down the word question, you know, if we ask questions of life, we have an interesting life. Question breaks down to quest, I on. So the minute we ask a question, we're on a quest. And this is so as a tracker, tracking is a natural form of inquiry that is based on a number of questions that are considered sacred because they help us to build our awareness, because we're continually asking these questions about everything, the things that are going on within us and around us. And it's through that mechanism that I've come to understand what I'm sharing with you. And I could talk about tracking for weeks, but I'm going to just drop that in there, because that's really, if you like, that's the engine of awareness is tracking, this notion of quest I on, of the question. And then there's the research, the search in the question, and so on. And then there's, if that's the idea, that's the principle, that's what I'm trying to figure out, then, you know, if I run this experiment, I'll be able to tell whether there's truth in that or not. And most shamanism is that. A place of, well, let's test it out. Let's verify this. Let's not just get into another state and have an experience and then not follow it up, not check that something has shifted in the physical, or that the symbols that we receive through our engagement in that, that we've really extracted the juice of meaning of those things. But I'm sort of digressing slightly. So, so what I found is that with the Alpha Breath Dynamics, each of us has a slightly different breath profile. And so I would recommend that you're somewhere between 4 and 6 seconds, with sort of 5 in them. And so I was doing this slow breathing, and then I started to link. I was stalking and doing Qigong and moving my body at the speed of this breathing. And I found that I was in an alpha state really fast, because I use wide angle vision the whole time. Since I was shown it some 25 years ago, I just adopted it. For me, it's a natural way of using the eyes. And it's far superior to this very narrow focus of vision. And there are a number of things that change that I haven't mentioned, experience. And I'll leave that to you. So we've got this peripheral vision, and then what we're going to do is slow the breath down to 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out. But that's not quite enough, because what I found is that if we synchronize a movement with the breath, as in Qigong, then within 2 minutes, we shift into an alpha state with only those three components. Okay, so I'd like you to just have a go at practicing that with me now. So this is 12 breaths that we're going to do. And I'm just going to raise my hands up like this and then lower them down. What I'd recommend for the first time is that you hold your hands out at the full periphery to help you stay in wide angle vision, and you raise them up and down as you breathe in for 5 and out for 5, or somewhere between 4 and 6. So I'm going to just do that practice. And what I'd like you to do before you engage in this is I'd like you to feel how you are right now internally and how it feels around you. And then I'd like you to do a similar kind of check-in when you've had a go at this. But like I said, we're doing one little practice. It might take, 5-10 practices for you to really get the hang of it, because there may be things that annoy you and pull you out of the practice in the process. And just to give you an idea of what I expect, I was running a camp a couple of years ago, about 50 people in the camp. I thought, okay, I'm going to run an experiment on these people. I'm going to teach them this technique, and I'm going to see how many students I have. So I got everybody round. I taught them alpha breath dynamics. They all shifted state really swiftly. A couple of days in, we're again in a big circle, everybody. I say, did anybody go off into the forest and practice that technique? One woman put up her hand and said, yes, I did. And all the birds started singing around, and this happened and that happened. I said, I have one student out of 50 people. So it's all very well me sharing this with you, but if you don't practice it, then it's a waste of everybody's time. So practice it to the point where you can make a clear decision as to whether or not it's helpful to you. And if it's not helpful, forget about it. If it is helpful, which I know it can be, then, make it part of your routine. Okay, are you ready? So, exhaling. So that's 12 breaths, about 2 minutes of practice. And so hopefully some of the things that you experienced were a sense of real presence, a calming of your inner, of the prefrontal cortex, a real sense of absorption, which is the word that I use to describe the flow or alpha state, sense of real absorption in what you're doing. So run some experiments and engage in the practice and see what happens. Some of the homework for you is to take this out into a natural environment and run an experiment there and see if your presence in that natural environment is experienced differently. Maybe you're feeling really stressed in a meeting. Go to the bathroom for 2 minutes, practice, come back, see if it can bring you into a state of more presence. Test it, basically. Don't just accept it, test it out and see if you can break it. And then, then maybe you'll take it up. I've also developed theta breath and delta breath dynamics, but I can't really share those as openly. So the natural state, we're fairly familiar with. We'll have means of access to the natural state. The theta state is a deeper state and requires a bit more training in order for us to know how to act in that state in a way that we're not going to hurt others or ourselves. It's a more potent state, and the same with the delta state. So how we access and work in those states really requires support and training. Whereas the alpha state, this is very much our natural state. And I would invite you to engage in that state as your preferred state, maybe, if you like it.
Because that's a lovely practice. There's lots of comments coming up about how much people got from that. We've got about 10 minutes left and there's some questions coming up. I wonder if that would be a good time to dip Great. Into some of those.
Please.
There have been a few questions around the natural resonance state that we're talking about. There's one wondering whether we could entrain to see it like a carrier wave. And somebody else was asking about, they moved from New York City to Tucson, Arizona, and they're finding they're much more at peace, and they're wondering whether that's to do with the resonance state. So they're sort of related, perhaps.
Okay, yeah. So, yes, there is a carrier wave, and this. So within the shamanic training, use that carrier wave as a way of communicating with entities that are within that energetic range, but nowhere near our physical person. So if we wanted to communicate with any entity, that could be a human, an animal, a living being, whatever it is, then we use that that resonance as the carrier wave to communicate with all living things. There are also techniques for communication with beings and entities that are within, touching distance. And so the movement from New York to Arizona is definitely going to create a more peaceful experience, because not only are you in an environment that is not where we couldn't measure the Schumann resonance, you're also really close to many, many other humans' fields. And as we become more sensitive, then we can pick up on all of that information. I could also talk about the relationship between sensitivity and resilience and the importance for developing resilience when we're really sensitive. It's much harder to train than it is resilience. And it starts off with focus on our boundaries. And the simplest approach to this is called armadillo medicine, where we take a sheet of paper, we draw a circle on the paper, and within the circle, we put everything we want in our lives. Outside the circle, we put all the things that we don't want. And this is effectively us setting an intention for where our boundaries are going to rest. And as we move through our experience and our resilience develops, we get to a point where we are so resting in our heart that we understand that a boundary is really us protecting ourselves from someone else's suffering. And when we understand that, we no longer require any boundaries because our heart reaches out and touches them. And instead, because we haven't dealt with whatever it is they're going through, our heart goes to meet them. And we say, hey, brother or sister, is there something you need? Or what do you need? That's where we come from and where we meet the other that is suffering. But the journey from setting up very clear boundaries to getting to the point where we've let them go, that's quite a long journey. And that's not something that I recommend anybody suddenly decide that they're going to go boundaryless. That's going to cause you some serious problems unless you know how to fully rest in the heart. And really, the experience of that has come to me through my understanding of martial arts. And, you know, I could again talk for hours about all of the things that stop us from resting in the heart, because resting in the heart, again, is our natural position. Why would we, you know, maybe we sit in meditation for a couple of hours and then we come out of it. And the minute we do, somebody does something that we react to. We're like, no, you've spoiled my state. When we've traded that feeling of space and peace and heartfulness for whatever that tiny little thing was that they used our milk, or they, you know, put a ticket on our car or whatever it was. And we're in the habit of making change of these tiny little things to fully rest in the heart. And this is, for me, is about the warrior of the heart. Do you have another question?
We've got quite a few, but there's one that might fit in here and that hasn't been referenced. What happens when there's a significant trauma from 0 to 4, very early days? What would that change the state? Would people get stuck in a particular state? Any thoughts on that?
I think that it might increase a lot of dissociation, because the flip side of spaciousness is dissociation. And it's like the tiniest degree of difference between feeling that source state, that quality of spaciousness and unconditioned nature, and being really dissociated. So I would expect those kind of qualities to be within a person's experience who was traumatized in that period of their experience. And then, you know, all of this maybe become difficult to access. But as adults, you know, the approaching the whole notion of the unconditioned is terrifying to us. And yet, if we were to be trained by the special forces, the main tool that they would use is not knowing, is mystery. Oh, we're going for a run. How long are we going for? We'll see. And maybe that's only 3 miles to start with, and then it's 10 miles and 20 miles and whatever it is. But the issue is that you're being trained through that process in meeting the unknown. And that's, yeah, that's one of, if we can feel okay with not knowing, with the unknown, we feel okay with whatever arises. And at that point, I think I'm going to have to finish.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. We'll have a quick closing word from you, but we're about to show you a video about the charity that we're supporting on this particular channel, which I think you'll see is absolutely appropriate.
Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or the other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organisation that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them, links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
Brilliant. So that's kind of a nice way to round off, I think. Thank you very much, Thomas. That's been a remarkable talk. I think we've learned some great techniques there as well. Just to let folks know, this is available for 48 hours for free. After that, if you want to buy the package, which is a pretty good deal, you can get access to all of these talks and have them for life. The next talk coming up is going to be on embodied inquiry. So it's a panel, it's a different approach in some ways, but a sort of related area because it's about how we can research techniques to inquire in an embodied way. So kind of curiously related, but from a more academic perspective. So we're mixing it up here in quite a fascinating way. So we're just bang on time. Again, thank you very much, Thomas.
You're really welcome. Thank you.